people may feel, say, betrayed or hurt. And those are all, I mean, I never argue with the emotion itself. Like there's never, the emotion is never the problem. So it's instead how the person is relating to it. And if you start to turn the emotion itself into a threat that must be prevented, you become then hypersensitive to anything that could trigger the emotion. And unfortunately, that means you could be on the lookout then for any evidence that would confirm your negative story about another person.
Before we get started, if you enjoy these episodes, you might want to explore more at optimalwork.com. Our website offers unique content, tools, and exercises to help you thrive at work and beyond. We have an in-depth masterclass which covers our entire theory of growth. We have daily recommendations for personalized advice, and we have a platform to help groups and organizations learn and practice optimal work together. You can get a free trial at optimalwork.com. Now let's get started with today's episode. Hey, this is Sharif, back with Dr. Kevin Majors. Kevin, good to be here with you again.
Hey, Sharif, great to be back.
Hey, Kevin. So sometimes when I'm giving talks on optimal work, I think the audience is pretty well on board with the idea of challenging themselves according to their highest ideals and overcoming negative emotions and so forth. But one question that I sometimes get is, okay, if I'm not like in the face of the challenge, I know that when I'm facing the challenge, I should try to, you know, act as well as I can according to my highest ideals. But then when I'm in another situation, say I'm with my friends recounting it, that isn't it okay then to just kind of vent about it or complain about it a little bit? So my instinct is to say, that's not very good, but mm-hmm. I want to get your thoughts on that. Maybe we can dive into this topic a little bit more.
Yeah, I think that there is a very widespread idea in culture that emotional health means periodically purging your system of negative emotions, and that we do that by venting them. So that if we don't have these periodic purges of our emotions, then we're going to develop some form of helplessness or anxiety or depression. So that idea is very deeply in American culture. So, and I think it was because of the kind of like the revolution in psychiatry where the Freudian ideas took over. Because this idea is directly from Freud. It's called the hydraulic theory or the cathartic theory. But it's this idea that emotions are like a pressure within us that we have to, that have to be released. Otherwise, I don't know, we explode. So, but I think that this is an important question. So, and to think then, like, how do we understand what's happening in people when, or in ourselves, when we are venting or attempted to vent? Because certainly we've all had the experience of feeling that we've been treated badly or we've been betrayed. And then what do you do with that? So there is actually interesting research out there that speaks to it. But that's the question, I think. What do you do with these very painful emotions when they're very inflamed and you feel like you just have to talk about it? Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that venting the emotion, I think people experience frequently that it makes you feel better in the moment, but that's not really the justification given for it here. The justification given for it here is that it kind of releases it and then helps you to be more cheerful or more kind or generous in the afterwards as well. And then if you don't do that, is that what repression is? That if you don't vent the emotion, you're kind of repressing it and that causes more problems later?
Exactly. Now, this goes back to Freud's original studies in hysteria. So where he talked about the dangers of repression. So this is, you know, well over 100 years old as a theory.
So, and you say that's not a good theory at all.
Well, fortunately, it's been studied. And there have been really interesting studies that have looked at this. The first time I read about this was I don't know, a long time ago. And it was a book by Carol Tavris called Anger, the Misunderstood Emotion. And that book was written in the 1980s and summarized the research until then. There's actually been a lot of research on this. So you might have heard of Albert Bandura. So he is very famous. He has this idea of self-efficacy. So and so that's what his research tended to focus on among a bunch of other contributions. But he famously, in the early 1970s, called for a moratorium on catharsis theory and the end of venting as a therapeutic technique. So the idea that getting people to vent in therapy about their parents and how bad their parents were, which is usually, like, that's a cottage industry. If you can get people to talk, like, to get, you know, talking about how bad their parents were, that gives you, like, another 10 sessions with someone at least. So they feel like, oh, there's so much here to go into. Okay, so catharsis theory has been studied again and again and again. To my knowledge, there is not a single study supporting it. So that shows that people who vent their emotion have somehow less of the negative emotion or more positive emotions, or they're less aggressive. No, none of that's ever been shown. In fact, it's the opposite. So this is one of those times where good research has been done that really has, I think, proven that venting doesn't work. So do people feel better after venting? Actually, no, they don't. So Bushman and his collaborators in, was it 2002, published this study that was of 600 college students. And then they divided them into different groups. And one of the groups, okay, well, what happened was all of them experienced a provocation because they were asked to write an essay, a short essay, on their opinion about abortion. And so they could be pro-abortion or anti-abortion, but they had to write an essay on it. And then they got someone's review where they basically said, this is like the dumbest argument I've ever heard. This was terrible. So now there was no reviewer. Everyone just got this provocative response, you know, saying how bad their essay was. So the idea being, okay, now this is a very, I don't know, it's a representative sample of the kind of things we might vent about. Someone unjustly criticizes something that we did and puts it down. And then they had divided them into three groups. So one group was instructed to punch a punching bag as hard and long as they wanted. But while they're punching, they should think about the anonymous reviewer. So the person who had written this. Okay, so that's one group. Another group was also given the punching bag, but they were told to think about what great exercise this was as they punched it. And then the third group was not given anything at all. They just basically sat and waited while the researcher did something for a few minutes and then checked in and gave them some scales to fill out. So these are the three groups. So catharsis theory would say that the people who didn't do anything with all that pent-up anger would feel worse at the end of the study. They would have more anger, they would feel more aggressive, and they would also then just like have less positive of mood. In fact, it was the opposite. So what happened was that the people who acted on their anger by punching the bag while thinking of the reviewer, in the end, were much more angry at the reviewer, and their mood was far worse. So having much less positive mood at the end of the study. So they were the worst off at the end. The people who punched the punching bag to, presumably like they were discharging, you know, whatever pent up anger there was, but without thinking of the person, you know, that they're trying to teach a lesson to. So they were in the middle. And the people who did nothing with it were actually the least angry. So that's, I think, an interesting snapshot of a study that confirms what has become now the standard accepted thing in cognitive behavioral therapy, that venting is not a useful therapeutic technique, that in the end, you're just going to get more of the same emotion. So until, you know, like, so people, the more they talk about these things, the more they dwell and ruminate on them, in fact, the worse they feel.
Before we continue, a brief message. If you're benefiting from these discussions, please hit like and subscribe to our channel. Doing so helps us reach more people, So you're not just learning yourself, you're helping others discover a path to growth and flourishing too. Thanks so much for your support. Enjoy the rest of the episode. Okay, Kevin, I have to bring this up because it seems like there's maybe could have been a fourth group. I remember in college during finals, to help people kind of de-stress, they would bring in Play-Doh for people to kind of play with in between studying for finals. Or I think at one point, I can't exactly remember, but maybe they had these puppies that you could go in and pet. But they never brought in a punching bag, which is kind of interesting. Maybe they could have. But so that seems like a fourth potential option. I don't know if there's anything to say about the effect that that might have had.
Yeah, so that would be all part of that middle distraction condition. So that they try to distract people from their anger. And in fact, in the study, they say that they could have used some other less aggressive distraction technique. And that would have probably made it even more obvious that the aggressive venting, because, I mean, many times people are told, and like in this kind of pop psychology, that you know, you should like punch a bag or punch a mattress or things like that. In the group of people who are punching the bag while thinking of the reviewer, one of the participants actually punched a hole in the wall in addition to the punching bag. So he was so mad about it. This is one of the footnotes in the study. It's interesting. So yeah, so it's true that I think a lot of people do distract themselves in various ways from their emotions. So that's interesting. Like, what is different about distraction versus just sitting with the emotion? You know, and this study wasn't designed to answer that. I think, you know, I think the experience is that when, like, you can ask the question, is venting an expression of willingness to have an emotion or unwillingness to have an emotion? Because when they vent, what are they venting about? Interestingly, they're not talking about their emotion. I would say as a rule, like right when people vent, it's not about the thoughts they're having and then the emotions those thoughts are triggering. It's all about the situation, the so-called, you know, facts of the situation. So people are, they just tell me like what this person said and what they did and how long it's been since they did this. And so people can have, you know, I remember one psychologist talking about a woman who was keeping a hate book against her husband so that when she eventually got divorced, like everything that annoyed her, all the facts like were written down in this book so that she could review them from time to time. So, but that's like that's dark, but it's a hyper-focus on details of a situation rather than actually using the experience of talking to someone else to better understand what thoughts has this triggered and what are the feelings that you have. So if talking about things could educate people in how to willingly feel an emotion, how to accept it, I don't think it would be venting. I think, in fact, that's what we do in therapy. You help people to, you know, they tell you the facts, you know, they tell you about the situation. And then the job of the therapist is to figure, or the confidant, whoever it is, I think their job is to figure out, okay, then what are the thoughts and feelings that this person is struggling with? What is it that we can help them to not be so afraid of? We can help them to accept this negative feeling. The more people then are accepting of these feelings, the less triggerable they are. So, and the less they'll feel the need to vent. So there's this education in how we approach our own emotions that's really important that venting doesn't get it. So venting is just trying to like hyper-focus on the situation as if the sympathy of the other person would be enough to allay the negative emotion. But that, in fact, doesn't work.
Kevin, I wonder, could you speak to the kind of neuroscience of what's going on here, like the underlying mechanism? Because we've done episodes past on thalamic gating, where the more you kind of pay attention to a certain stimulus or phenomenon, then the more you'll tend to experience it. It seems like something similar might be going on here, where the more you vent the emotion, the more you're going to feel it in the future. So it's this kind of, you're trying to get rid of it, but actually you're just deepening the habit and it becomes more of a vicious cycle. So is something similar to that going on here?
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. Yes. So one thing is the more you are, the more you're interiorly struggling with an emotion that you don't want to feel, the more on alert you are for anything that could trigger it. So people may feel, say, betrayed or hurt, and those are all, I mean, I never argue with the emotion itself. Like, there's never the emotion is never the problem. So it's instead how the person is relating to it. And if you start to turn the emotion itself into a threat that must be prevented, you become then hypersensitive to anything that could trigger the emotion. And unfortunately, that means you could be on the lookout then for any evidence that would confirm your negative story about another person. So if this person is always insensitive, they're always a jerk, they never think of me, then you'll be noticing evidence left and right. So, and this is the essence of what's called the confirmation bias. You're gonna have a warping in your ability to notice things, where you're only, because of this, your struggle with the underlying emotion, not wanting it to be triggered, then you become hypersensitive to triggers, and you end up then, everything ends up confirming your worst fears. So you constantly have this confirmation bias. So I think that's part of it. There's a research, Berkowitz, who has something called the cognitive neo-association theory, which is held to be the opposite of the catharsis theory, where it says that by talking about these highly charged facts, when people are venting, you're just increasing the association of thoughts about those things with the emotion that you're trying to avoid. So it's another way of saying what I was just saying. And so it does seem like your memory then starts knitting together all these experiences more and more powerfully the more you talk about them. So you kind of, you turn it into much more of a thing. It becomes something very rote in your mind. And then it just feels like it's self-evident truth. And it becomes hard to investigate it anew. And in fact, we end up justifying ourselves.
So maybe next we could talk about catharsis, which we talked about earlier, which comes, you mentioned, from, this is part of Freud's theory, but it goes back to Aristotle and his approach to drama and helping people to, to bring out the emotions in the audience. But so is his take basically the same as Freud's? So you have to get people to experience and kind of vent these emotions, or I say that facetiously.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So Aristotle is the one who talked about catharsis of emotion. It's in the Poetics, and he talks about pity and fear as being the two emotions that are purged in the audience as they watch the tragedy unfold on stage. So interesting that what he's talking about there is, one, it's entirely based on empathy. So that the audience is being trained in empathy for the situation that is producing the evil for the good people. And that impending evil produces fear, and then when it arrives, it produces pity. So you feel sad for them. And he thought that directing these things to the right objects was the ethical use, of stimulating an emotion. So that the goal is that there are these situations where you're making judgments about guilt and innocence and how deserved or undeserved the sufferings are for people. And that what he thought was very healthy, that you're training people's emotions to be more ethical. So that ethical dimension, which is also in Aristotle a communal dimension, that these are happening in public tragedies, they're being watched together, is entirely missing then in the psychoanalytic process of catharsis, which was, Breuer used hypnosis and Freud used free association, but those the two kind of fathers of the psychoanalytic cathartic theory thought that it's the individual And these, they're kind of the repressed, pressurized emotions that have to be released to achieve catharsis. In Aristotle, it's not about releasing an emotion at all. It's about directing emotions to their proper object, which are ethical concerns, rather than simply, I don't know, like the lower concerns people could have. So it's interesting that with Aristotle, it's more about bringing ideals of justice and compassion into the emotional experience, like leavening emotion with ideals. That actually is the purging.
So the idea is that you're, for all the range of human emotions, you're supposed to kind of feel certain ones for certain situations, like anger if you're being unjust.
Yeah.
Well, you are supposed to feel anger if you're unjustly attacked or there's a righteous anger, but or sadness if mm-hmm. there's some evil. And so this process is trying to teach you how to kind of match the right emotion with the right situation.
Exactly. And so the idea is that the catharsis, which is actually like a purifying or cleansing, in Aristotle is more of like a rational, making it rational, so that the emotions are made conformable to the right object and reason, like the right object as determined by reason. So that is the goal then, is like, how do you rightly form the emotions so that they, also, I mean, in the rhetoric, he talks about pity and nemesis. And that's what Aquinas quotes more often. And usually when I'm talking about why scary movies are like the modern tragedies. So scary movies are all about these emotions, right? Pity, fear, nemesis. Nemesis is the joy you have, you know, at seeing the deserved suffering of the evil. In some ways, you know, it's like scary movies are actually where we are kind of trained, that the, one, you know, series actually that I think of with this is The Purge. And if you've seen any of those, I've seen three of them on VidAngel. So it takes out certain scenes that I don't like. But the principle of The Purge is that once a year, it's legal for 12 hours to commit any crime, including murder. And so you have these 12 hours, you know, where people are encouraged to purge because it's like how you release anger. And this led to like a new era of prosperity in America. In fact, the whole movie is about what happens with the purging of anger. So does it actually do people good? And in fact, it's clear that it doesn't, that it's completely destructive. And does this lead to a new like golden age? Well, in fact, in the end, if you are okay with this kind of purging, this kind of venting, it's the poor and the powerless who will undoubtedly suffer the most. And so it's about how, in fact, the rich become predators. I think actually there's a lot of Aristotelian theory behind those series. I'm not recommending people watch them, but it is interesting, just this idea that, you know, is it like a part of the common good that we get people venting? And I think no, the answer, you know, it's clearly not. So,
yeah, it's interesting. For Aristotle, it's about getting people to experience the emotion, not vent it, and that seems like remarkably similar to what you do in exposure therapy. So he's kind of anticipating this, no?
Yeah. No, I think that exactly. I think that what he's talking about is tragedy as exposure therapy, which is why I mentioned the scary movies, because I think of that as being exposure therapy. That if people struggle with feelings of anxiety, then watching something that provokes it is a way of, a safe way of doing an exposure. But yeah, I think that in Aristotle, the entire thing is part of an ethical framework. So this gets to another point, which is that where, you know, one of the sources in the thinking of Freud and Breuer for catharsis was the confessional. So the practice that Roman Catholics have of confessing their sins to a priest. And what they thought they had arrived at, and they explicitly say this, is a way of achieving the same relief from tension, but without the need for absolution. So they were deliberately trying to get people, when they first taught this kind of cathartic venting theory, you know, they thought that this is reproducing the goods of confession without needing the whole apparatus of God and the church and morality. So I remember, I remember being told that there is this famous psychiatrist in Europe who, when he was pointing to like the locked asylum that they had, he told a visiting priest that, none of these people would be here if they went to confession. Okay. I think that we have to be not impressed at all, with that statement. That statement is not saying that confession has miraculous effects, at least not necessarily. Really, that sentiment was widespread among Freudians, and really the belief is much more about the power of catharsis, that they're really saying that these people all have neuroses that are the result of repressed emotions, and confession would have been a good cathartic mechanism. So, but I don't think they believe that it's because of the absolution or the grace or anything like that that Catholics might think. So I don't think Catholics should be impressed with statements like that.
It seems like with confession, it's flipped. It's where with venting, you're kind of complaining about it or talking about a situation and venting your frustration with that situation, whether it's something external to you that you're focused on is bad and you're expressing that. Whereas, in confession, it's you're saying, well, I did this. So,
exactly. I think that it's flipped entirely. So you just think like, we can think about the times in our past where we vented about something, and we can ask ourselves, through the process of venting, did we come to a more balanced, reasonable view of a situation? I don't know if that's really likely. It's not suggested by any research that I know of that this is a way of attaining a more balanced outlook. If you vent about how terrible someone is, does that in itself lead you to see them in a more positive light? No, in fact, it just confirms a negative light. Just all the behavioral dynamics of venting are in the wrong direction. But if you can identify something that you can take ownership of that you did wrong, so let's say you got in a fight with someone. Well, let's say then a person's Catholic and they go to confession and they confess, that they perhaps, maybe had rash judgment where they jumped, to conclusions about the other person's motive. And then they, were impatient with the person and then sinned through anger. So all of those things, the more you take ownership of them for what you contributed to the situation, well, that actually changes your view of the situation really profoundly and allows you to have more compassion on the other person who also may have done things that were terrible. So it's not saying that we somehow are obliged to approve of everything that other people do. No, not at all. We can be accepting of the fact that we aren't perfect and they aren't perfect. They might have done some bad things or said some bad things, but it doesn't necessarily make them a bad person. And we also did some things. So I think that when you take ownership of what you can, and you kind of resist the urge to justify yourself against the other person, and flip it around and accept whatever you can, you try to find the biggest opportunity for your own growth in how you approach this thing and how you could have approached it. That's a very different thing. You come up with a very balanced view then, and you end up moving on, I think, much more easily.
Well, Kevin, I think that kind of leads naturally into my last question for you today, which is about in dealing with other people who might be venting. I'm sure you have people come to your practice. I don't know, maybe it's the first session and they expect they're just going to be able to come here and vent for 30 minutes or 45 minutes or whatever it is. Or maybe in the context of friendship or mentoring that you experience it, sometimes people want to vent. So what is the best way if someone is venting to you to, I guess now you're saying it's not good. So we probably want to, we can't just say, okay, stop venting and grow up and deal with it. There has to be some kind of good way of, redirecting a conversation or something like that to get to something more helpful. How would you, what guidance would you give people on that?
The first thing is, and this might seem contrary to what I've said, but I think the first thing really is actually making sure you deeply listen. You know, and so I'm listening to see, okay, how are they framing the situation? This is a way of collecting facts and getting to know the situation that they're describing. But that's not the kind of the end goal. It's just an initial step. So they need to understand that you you see like the problem, that they're seeing some problem, they come to you with it, and it might be another person and how this person is treating them. And so while you don't really focus on that other person, like, oh, that, they're real bad. I'm so, you know, you do have to register, like, wow, that sounds like that was really tough for you. So you have to validate in some way what they're going through. And so as a listener, you need to get to the point where you know you're validating them. So that takes some listening at first. So you just listen and ask some open-ended questions until you get to the point where you can really validate. But then you need to go deeper and you get into not just the facts, but how is this impacting them? Really, what are the emotions? So when all this is happening, tell me, like, what's that like for you? And you're trying to get at what is their emotional response. They will reveal then the emotions they have a hardest time accepting. So, and often then that is the main challenge. It's not so much learning how to deal with this other person. The more immediate task is learning how to be able to handle this emotion so that this emotion can in some way bring out their best. So I think in general, when people are venting about things, really it's like they're saying, I have an emotion I don't yet know how to talk about. And I don't yet know how to accept. So I'm giving you all these things, all these facts, so that you can kind of help me understand the emotion and put it into words. So in a way, that's like, I think the real solution is in the end, helping them to name the emotion and the experience that they're so unwilling to have. And that's where you can be really empathic. It is hard to have these. But in themselves, these emotions are not bad. And in fact, they can be the setting for your like really deeper development. Even in the midst of these emotions, you can act according to your highest ideals. So, and it actually gets back to the kind of Aristotelian idea of catharsis, that the person has the emotional experience, but then, you know, like in the midst of that, there's also these ideals that they're aiming for. So, and I think that's a very powerful thing. That even these emotions can bring out your best. There's a beautiful way you can respond in the midst of this.
Yeah. Well, Kevin, I think that's a beautiful note for us to end on here. Actually, before we end on, I just want to make a quick plug because used some words that were familiar to me, empathic, validating, and I picked up. There's more on that in the course that we have on optimalwork.com. on how to have these transforming conversations, on how to mentor people, how to coach people. So if you want more of that fully fleshed out over a couple hours and going into all the details of how to encourage people in those situations, how to flip them around, and then how to make practical steps to grow in that area, there's a whole course on that on optimalwork.com.
Great. Check it out.
That's it for today. So Kevin, thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks, Sharif.
All right. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. If you enjoyed our conversation and you're looking for more in-depth guidance, check out optimalwork.com, our platform of content, tools, and exercises that will help you thrive at work and beyond. See you next week.